Good morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and welcome everybody to Senate Finance. It's 9:37 a.m. Thursday, April 13, 2010, and I apologize for the late start, but as we go into the final days of session, we'll try to keep on time, but today we, got derailed a little bit, so. Because I know everybody has lots of other things going on than what's actually in front of the committee at any given moment. With me today is my co-chair, Senator Hoffman, Senator Ellis, Senator Olson, Senator Huggins, Senator Thomas, and Senator Egan. We have a full committee today and a full agenda. We have 10 bills on the agenda this morning. House Bill 20, Fisheries Loan Energy Efficiency, followed by House Bill 344, Salmon Product Development Tax Credit. House Bill 52, Post-Trial Jury Counseling. House Bill 354, Alaska Capstone Revolving Loan Fund. House Bill 168, Trauma Care Centers. House Bill 306, State Energy Policy. House Bill 114, Use State Transportation Facility for Disaster Aid. House Bill 186, Alaska Firearms Exempt from Federal Regulations. House Bill 319, Firearms. House Bill 315, Public Accounting. Colleagues down the hall have been busy. So we're going to start with House Bill 20 by Representative Edgman regarding fisheries loans for energy and efficiency loans. This is the second hearing on this bill. We first heard it on April 12th. The intent today is to bring the bill back to address any concerns members may have and look to the will of the committee. We can have representation from the bill sponsor. And do members have any questions or concerns on this bill? We have one fiscal note from the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development for $88,600 in Commercial Fisheries Revolving Loan Fund. We have previously had public testimony. We have Representative Edgman. Would you like to make some comments before I look to the will of the committee on the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Bryce Edgman, Representative for House District 37. Concerning the issue that was brought up yesterday when the bill was before the committee regarding the definition of engines and generators, I did check with the Division of Investments Director. And Mr. Chairman, I think generators are sufficiently covered in terms of the statutory language that's in the bill.
Okay, thank you. Any final comments from the committee members? Senator Hoffman.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I move the Senate Finance Committee pass out Senate CS for House Bill 20 with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
We have a motion to move the bill from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. Do we have objection? Seeing none, we'll move the bill from committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yep. Next up, House Bill 344 by Representative Thomas regarding salmon product development tax credits. This is the second hearing on this bill. We first heard it April 12th. The intent today is to bring the bill back to address concerns members may have and look to the will of the committee. We have representation from Representative Thomas's office. Do we have any questions for the bill sponsor? Seeing none, we have 1-0 fiscal note from the Department of Revenue, and we've had public testimony, so that is closed. Do we have any final comments from the bill sponsor?
For the record, Peter Eklund, staff, Representative Thomas. No, Mr. Chairman, just thank you for hearing the bill today.
And just for those watching at home that weren't watching yesterday, give us a little quick overview of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What the bill would propose to do is extend the existing salmon product development tax credit 4 years from 2011 to 2015. And the tax credit would give 50% tax credit for qualified investment for value-added equipment to add value to salmon products. And fisheries businesses, processors could deduct 50% of their fisheries business tax against that tax credit, Mr. Chairman. And it also adds, there is one change that it adds to existing statute where ice machines would also qualify for the tax credit.
Okay. Do we have any final questions? Senator Hoff.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move the Senate Finance Committee pass out CS for House Bill 344 with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
We have a motion to move the bill from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. Do we have objection? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and move the bill from committee to the next committee of referral. Next up, House Bill 52 by Representative Cartula regarding post-trial jury counseling. This is the second hearing on this bill. We first heard it April 12th. Intent today is to bring the bill back to address concerns members may have and look to the will of the committee. We have representation from Representative Cartula's office. Do we have questions for the representative's office, bill sponsor? We have one fiscal note for $15,000 in general funds, and we've had public testimony, and that is now closed. If we could, from the bill sponsor, if we can get a brief synopsis of what this bill is for those that, at home that aren't familiar with it, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Hannah McCarty, staff to Representative Cartula. This bill would allow for up to 10 hours of counseling for a juror who experiences a trial that is excessively graphic, gruesome, or emotional testimony or evidence.
Okay, thank you. We have a motion.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move the Senate Finance Committee pass out House Bill 52 with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
We have a motion to move the bill from committee to the next committee referral with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. Do we have objection? Seeing none, we'll move the bill from committee to the next committee referral. Next up, House Bill 354 by Representative Keller regarding the Alaska Capstone Avionics Revolving Loan Fund. This is the second hearing on this bill. We first heard it on the 12th of April. The intent today is to bring it back and address concerns members may have and look to the will of the committee. Do we have representation from the bill sponsor? I see him coming in the room, Rep. Keller. Is there any questions for the representative? We have 1-0 fiscal note from the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, and we've previously had public testimony that is closed. Rep. Keller, if you could give us a brief synopsis for those watching at home what this bill is before we take action.
The capstone bill, we're changing the funds so that aircraft operators in Alaska that lease their aircraft can qualify to use the loan to equip their airplane with the capstone equipment. We heard the bill the other day, and I guess there's been something that's transpired, if I could, on the ensuring and the regulation that the aircraft will be operated.
Could you identify yourself for the record?
I'm sorry, Representative Keller, District 14, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
And you were, what were you previously saying there was?
I'd like, if I could, ask my staff to explain something that was done that they agreed to in the regulations.
Okay, if you can introduce yourself to start with and who you represent, and then.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Matt Johnson. I am staff to Representative Keller. There was a concern raised about the capstone avionics being placed in the aircraft and the aircraft then leaving the state. What has been agreed to is that it will be put in regulation that when a lessee's lease is up, they will have 120 days to re-up the lease or purchase the aircraft, or at such time as the 120 days is up, they will have to come up with the full amount and pay the loan in full. And I believe Greg Winninger is here to speak to that from the Department of Investments, if you would like him to speak to that.
We have anybody on the sign-up sheet? So I'd like to remind everybody, if you have a bill up, you want to be on the sign-up sheet, including administration officials, so I know who's in the room to testify on what. Do we have any questions for the bill sponsor? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The only question that I have for the bill sponsor is, who has been taking advantage of the capstone loan project? Are these commercial operators? Are these individuals? Or do you know what the spread is between those people that subscribe to the program?
Senator Olson, through the chair, I do not know the specific breakdown, and I would advise asking that to the department.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Do we have any other questions for the bill sponsor? We've got 1-0 fiscal note from the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development. Remember if I had mentioned that, and then we previously had public testimony. Senator Hoffman.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move the Senate Finance Committee pass out House Bill 354 with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Okay, we have a motion to move the bill from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note. Do we have objection? Seeing no objection, we'll go ahead and move the bill from committee. The next committee, a referral.
Thanks, sir. Committee.
Next up, Senate Bill 168 by Senator Coghill regarding trauma care centers. This is the first hearing on this bill. We heard the Senate companion bill, Senate Bill 168, on March 10th. The intent today is to have the sponsor introduce the bill, entertain amendments, take public testimony. If Senator Coghill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, the manager of this particular bill is Representative Bob Herron, because it came from the House. If you wish, you can have him come forward.
Yes, Rep. Herron.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Representative Bob Herron. On House Bill 168, this legislation would create a trauma care fund which could reimburse trauma centers for uncompensated or undercompensated services and then create incentives for becoming a certified trauma center. Sir, this legislation, of course, was introduced by my former House colleague, and with your permission, sir, I'd like to have the senator address the balance of the opening remarks and answer any questions.
Senator Coghill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Coghill, District F. This is a piece of legislation I've been working on for a number of years. It does simply create a fund and give people reasons to go into that fund. What I'm looking for is the establishment of a fund that gives the incentives to hospitals to raise their level of designation for trauma. And this primarily will go to uncompensated and undercompensated care, so that the hospitals would have some place to work with the doctors who work in the trauma centers, the ERs. And so what we asked for was $2.5 million to travel along as a fiscal note, and we asked for the authorization to go after disproportionate share money, which is hospital that is money that goes through hospitals under Medicaid, that after all the billing cycle is completed, we are able to get a 50% match. So I think we can actually draw people in with this money to raise the level of trauma designation in Alaska. There's several large hospitals in Alaska that I would like to encourage. This is a approach that is obviously it's incentive driven, whereas many states have mandated these issues happen. And I think in Alaska, with the kind of the fragile nature of the geography and the large economic centers like Anchorage, population centers, I mean, incentive is the best approach.
Okay. We have any initial questions for the bill sponsor? Seeing none, we've got an amendment. Senator Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd move amendment number one and be happy to explain.
I will object for explanation. Senator Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. President, or Mr. Chairman. I'm very supportive of the efforts here in the bill. Have worked with the original House sponsor and his staff on this amendment. And what the amendment proposes to do is just require that hospitals actually show improvement to be eligible for the funds. That's the intent of the bill, to get an improvement in the level of trauma care. So this would require improvements to access the money. We don't want to spend state money to support what's already being done. And like I said, I've discussed it with the original House sponsor. It was originally drafted to be a committee substitute. That's not before us, so the amendment route is what I was advised to pursue. So that's amendment number one.
And is the bill sponsor in support of amendment number one?
Mr. Chairman, yes, sir. It did get dropped out of one CS, and the main reason, in my view, was that we were looking for ways to let the regulation process get to that very target. And in reviewing the language again, I think this does fall well within the target of what we want to get done. It gives kind of a trust but verify approach, so I'm okay with it, and I think it'll work.
Okay. I'll go ahead. And any other questions on the amendment? Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's my understanding there's a professional organization that makes these designations. Is that correct for level 1, 2, 3, 4, 5? I believe there's 5 levels.
It's a national organization that you go through a rigorous review, much like you would, say, for a doctorate program at a university. They have to have peer review, and then they actually give the designation, yes.
Okay, that's what I thought. Thank you.
Any other questions on the amendment? I'll go ahead and remove my objection to adoption of Amendment Number 1. Any further objection to adoption of Amendment Number 1? Seeing none, Amendment Number 1 is adopted. We're back to the main bill. Do we have any questions on the bill as amended? Initial questions. We have 2-0 fiscal notes from the Department of Health and Social Services and the Department of Revenue. There's one fiscal note from the House Finance Committee reflecting the need for $2,500,000 in general funds to match $2,500,000 in federal disproportionate share hospital funds. And we have William Stern. Hard to read the handwriting from S.
Oh, I'm sorry. It was Deputy William Struer.
Is there anybody from the administration who want to speak to this bill? Well, I need somebody from the administration to ask a question to. Introduce yourself for the record and who you represent, please.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, I'm Bill Stewart, Deputy Commissioner, Medicaid and Health Policy, Department of Health and Social Services.
And?
Wilda Laughlin, Legislative Liaison for Health and Social Services.
Don't be shy, Wilda. You've been here lots of times. Does the department support the bill or have any concerns with the bill?
The department supports the concept of trauma centers. We're neutral on the fiscal note.
Okay. Do we have any questions for the administration on the bill? Seeing none, we'll go to the off-net, and we'll ask Dr. Frank Sacco to identify himself for the record, who he represents, and speak to the bill, please, and try to keep it within 2 minutes.
Yeah, Thank you very much. I'm Frank Sacco. I'm the trauma surgeon and the trauma director at the Alaska Native Medical Center, and I'm speaking actually as the chair of the Alaska Trauma Systems Review Committee, which looks at trauma care throughout the state and is made up of representatives of pre-hospital and of the various hospitals from all the geographic regions. Trauma is a huge problem in this state, public health problem, second leading cause of death, and we have the second highest rate in the country. And it's been really clear that if you have trauma systems, it's been shown all over the country that we can decrease the mortality by 15% to 25% for seriously injured folks. We had a review of our trauma care by the College of Surgeons, and we really fall behind a lot of the country. We're the only state without a designated level 2 trauma center that serves the majority of the population. The Native Hospital is a level 2 but serves primarily Natives. The College of Surgeons report showed a way forward. We've made some of the changes, but one of the changes was having an incentive for the hospitals that aren't currently participating to become designated and raise the level of care and improve outcomes. And I think that this bill helps move us forward, and there will be an incentive for the hospitals to participate. The outcome will be lives will be saved. Other states have mandated this and have used a real stick approach. I think the College of Surgeons was right on in that we should start with this. But they also recommended that this is too important to let not happen for the state, and if it doesn't work, we need to get all the hospitals going. We need to save lives. We can save 40 to 50 lives a year with this program, and I just want to strongly recommend, I'll be glad to answer any questions, but I think that this is a great step forward.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. That's the only person we have signed up on the off-net. We have nobody in the LIOs and nobody signed up in the room. So that will conclude our public testimony portion. Do we have any, maybe we can get the bill sponsor back? Bill sponsors. Do we have any final questions for the bill sponsors? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a comment. I think that this bill certainly goes a long ways to get us up to the level that you want to see, because as not just a health care provider, but when you're out in Bush, Alaska, you got a four-wheeler, a snowmobile accident, or even an airplane accident, you pick up the phone and sometimes you don't know what kind of experience the person on the other end is going to have. And so it weights the amount of credibility you give to the advice, and I think this certainly makes it so that when you pick up the phone, you know that the guy on the other end or the personnel on the other end have got a pretty good idea and have a fair amount of experience. And I do agree with Dr. Sacco that the number of lives that will be saved is certainly going to be on the increase, and it gets it up us up to a standard that we can be more comfortable with, especially as we continue on with some of these trauma cases throughout the state.
We have any other final questions for the bill sponsor? Final comments by the bill sponsor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, in our budgets down through the years, we have put a lot of money into EMS system, ambulances, trying to figure out ways to get air ambulances to better work. And we have invested a lot in first responders. But if we have good first responders and get them to the hospital and they have to wait for a couple hours to take care of some of the trauma, to me it's just unacceptable. We can do better. And just the fact is that the hospitals in Anchorage and in Fairbanks could go through a designation that it gets them to a level where they guarantee that a certain level of service will be available all the time. Right now they're able to do it on a regular basis, but it is not going to be as consistent as I think we need to do in Alaska. And this bill says this is just one little bucket in the bucket brigade of trying to make sure that our Alaskans get the care that they think they're going to get, and yet many times can't. And so it's an incentive based. And if we put this into law, it will be my intention to make sure that incentive works as it's supposed to. There's a lot of people in Alaska who care about taking care of people who are injured. And they don't ask, were you doing something foolish? Were you doing something worthy when you got hurt? But when you get hurt, we pick them up and we take care of them. And alcohol and related drugs cause many traumas. So the higher the level of trauma designation, the more likely we're going to have a system where we catch people and use that teachable moment through some counseling to turn them, and that becomes kind of the preventative part of the trauma care system. So the higher level of the designation, the better off Alaskans are going to be, in my view. And this is just one step in the process, and I appreciate you hearing it.
Okay. Thank you. We'll go ahead and set this bill aside for further review. Pick up the next item of business is House Bill 306 by the House Energy Committee regarding the state energy policy. This is the first hearing on this bill. The intent today is to have the sponsor introduce the bill, entertain amendments, and take public testimony and set the bill aside for further review. With us today is Representative Hedgman.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Bryce Hedgman, House District 37. The legislation you have before you would create a statewide comprehensive energy policy. The bill itself is a product of a working group comprised of a diverse group of stakeholders in the energy sector all throughout Alaska. And the bill ties together basically all the facets of energy moving forward in the 21st century, including conservation, efficiency, renewable, non-renewable, addressing the fact that a lot of the energy solutions probably are going to come up at the ground level, at the community level. And it also, Mr. Chairman, speaks to the fact that Alaska is a resource development state, that energy is tied into economic development, and that certainly to go forward with solving the energy problem in Alaska, or at least providing affordable, stable energy, we need to recognize that the fiscal regime is important as well. And I would also say that on the front page of the legislation, there is legislative intent languages that points towards some specific objectives. The bill did pass the House unanimously. It comes forth with a zero fiscal note, Mr. Chairman, and has been vetted by a number of committees.
Do you have any initial questions for the bill sponsor? We have an amendment. Senator Huggins.
Yeah, can we have a brief at ease?
Brief at ease. On the record, there is no amendment number one. We have 1-0 fiscal note from the House Energy Committee. We've got seeing no initial questions from the committee. We'll go to the public hearing portion, and we'll go to the list. There's four people. If you could start by introducing yourself for the record, who you represent, and then speak to the subject matter. But first, you're going to have to come forward to the committee. Chris Rose.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Chris Rose, Executive Director, Renewable Energy Alaska Project. REAP is a coalition of 71 organizations around the state, including over 15 utilities, over 30 businesses, environmental groups, consumer groups, Alaska Native organizations. And we are in support of this bill. I was one of the 16 stakeholders that met with the Special Committee on Energy over the course of the summer, starting in July through December. It was a very diverse group of folks. As Representative Edgman pointed out, we worked through this process by consensus. It was an interesting process in that I think a lot of us had different goals that we wanted to have in this energy policy. And at one point, the policy ballooned up to about 7 pages. And then we all realized that what we needed to do was come up with an overarching vision of what the energy policy for the Alaska should be. I think the real reason that this is an important bill is that the state doesn't have an energy policy. We have a lot of plans, we have programs, we have projects, and sometimes those get confused with an overall vision of where the state needs to go. The rest of the world is very competitive. They have energy policies. Many of those policies are mandates. This is not a mandate. As Representative Edgman pointed out, some goals are in intent language at the beginning of the bill. But we all agreed that what we needed to have is a framework, a vision, overall policy in which to put our strategic goals, which the legislature can develop, and then implement those goals through programs and projects. I think some of the things that the Declaration of Energy Policies states are important. They note what is happening in the rest of the world, what's likely to happen, and that is increasing supply and demand on this planet for fossil fuels is going to trend the price of those fuels up. We're already seeing that, as well as carbon regulation is likely to trend the price of those fuels up. And so that's one of the reasons that renewable energy is an important part of this bill, but it's not the only part of it. Clearly, it's a promotion of both renewable and non-renewable alternative fuels. It does make it very clear that energy efficiency and conservation is first and should be our first investment. It really is the cheapest unit of energy is the one you save rather than the one you generate. And it also supports things like education, training, workforce development, so that we have the people here in the state of Alaska to do this work. And lastly, it works on coordinating government functions so that we are able to work on the implementing these goals as efficiently as possible. That's my testimony. I appreciate the opportunity to testify. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony today. Steve Higginson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Stephen Higginson. I'm the Executive Director of Alaska Energy Authority. Alaska Energy Authority was an official member of the work group, but they invited us to participate, and we enjoyed the interaction throughout the interim. We had a lot of passionate people in the room, and I think we all, as a group, put in a lot of good ideas, and as a result of most work products, it came out as a group effort, and I think everybody supported the final result. At the end of the time. So it was a very good process. I think we had a lot of input from a lot of people across the public, and I'm happy to say I was part of that process.
The bill here targets 50% of our electrical generation in the state to be from renewable energy sources by 2025, out 15 years. Can you give us a ballpark where you think the state is currently and where we need, how we get to, or where we need to be to get to 50%?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Today the state's about 24% of renewable for our electrical needs. And that's including hydro. If you look at the lower 48 standards, they typically don't include hydro as a renewable. I believe the both bodies have put a joint resolution in saying that they'd like to see hydro as renewable. So for this conversation, we're going to assume hydro is renewable, and 24% of our current energy is from renewable today for electricity. If you start looking at the pieces of the state and take out the rail belt, you can see that we're somewhere right around 63% today renewable, mainly driven by the hydro in Southeast Alaska and the size of the communities in Southeast Alaska. So It's achievable. We have a lot of resources we can do. We can use to achieve that ultimate goal. If you look at the rail belt again, we've recently completed an integrated resource plan for the rail belt that looks at renewables for electric, and they actually forced the result to go to a 50% renewable target. And what the recommendation is it will have large hydro. Either Chacachamna, Susitna, or Glacier Fork is one of the solutions to get to the 50% target for the rail belt. So if you take the two numbers, the 50% achievable in the rail belt and average amount, you'll get something above 50% for the electrical needs for Alaska in that type of time frame.
And then under that model, and we need to go forward with one of the big hydros that Senator Thomas has been bringing up for the last couple of years, and I think we have 10 million in the capital budget currently to move forward. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. We're also looking at the rest of the state and developing a model that will look at renewables available to each community in Alaska. It looks at local fuels that can be used in your backyard to power the needs of your community. And when that result comes out, you'll see it's not just a Southeast picking up the load for most of the hydro and maybe a large hydro in the rail belt. There'll be a methodology for across the state of Alaska.
And has there been much integration thought about in this process if we had a bullet line or a major gas line and we had gas-fired electric turbines? What does that do to this target?
Mr. Chairman, the Integrated Resource Plan looks at mainly most of the projects you just mentioned are in the rail belt area, and the Integrated Resource Plan looks at the mix of fuel. Even with the large hydro in place, still about 50% of the fuel comes from natural gas, so there will be a need for natural gas in the future. But the the study we're doing right now does not specifically look at the bullet lines or the GGA pipelines. That's being handled by other people.
Okay. We have any other questions for Mr. Higginson? Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Steve, for your testimony. I missed the, of the 24% that we have now, what was the breakdown of that? I missed your comment.
At the 24% renewables in Alaska right now, about most of that is about 0.3% is non-hydro. So this is basically a hydro-driven number. 0.3 is a pretty small number.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Higginson? Okay. Thank you. And then maybe we're going to have Mike Ford around from the Department of Law. You disappear? How about Brian Borquist?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Brian Bjorkquist. I'm a senior assistant attorney general for the state of Alaska.
Could you help us if what exposure, if any, do we have as a state if we don't meet our 50% goal by 2025?
Mr. Chairman, that goal is in Section 1, which is part of the legislative intent. That if the state did not meet that goal, there isn't a statutory mandate or any liability that could arise from that. It would just be that the legislative intent would not have been met. The legislative intent section expresses goals that the legislature is giving to to state agencies as they go forward, and so the consequences would be more of a political nature than a legal nature.
Okay, thank you. Do we have any questions for the department? Okay. Thank you. We've got...
Mr. Chairman?
Yes?
If I could just have a moment and have two other comments about the bill. First, there is one word in the bill that the department believes may cause some problems as we go forward. That is on page 3, line 22, in the middle of that national. What this says is that and this is part of Section 2, which is codified statute, and it requires that coordinating governmental functions to meet national emissions, renewable energy, and energy production targets. Having national there, that word may impose upon the state an obligation to meet whatever federal targets, et cetera, are established in those areas. A recommendation to improve the bill would be to just delete the word national so that it would just be to meet emissions, renewable energy, and energy production targets. That way Alaska could impose its own and work on its own targets as opposed to necessarily having a statute saying that the state of Alaska in its energy plan is to try to meet national targets, as we don't have any control over what those targets might be. That's the first comment. And then the second comment related to your question on the 50% targets, and that is that one possibility from codifying the state energy policy is that there could be some unintended consequences. Having in statute the energy policy, it could be used by folks who are dealing with state agencies and or in litigation to suggest that these policy points need to be implemented by other state agencies and or affect litigation affecting the state in ways that might not be thought of right now. And it's just by codifying it rather than having a policy in uncodified law or in intent language such as Section 1, individual components of it might be used in some way that would create some unintended consequences at this point. That's just an observation that the Department of Law wanted to share.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for the Department of Law? Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In regards to the comment you just made, You started out with the meet national emissions, and I understand that. And you're saying almost anything in here someone could take a look at, say, on page 2B, decreasing public building energy consumption through conservation measures. That's page 2, lines 15 and 16. Obviously, as you're building new buildings, you would have to be decreasing. You would be increasing in that case with a new building immediately and not reaching your goal. Is that why you're concerned with it being in statute?
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, yes. And those types of reading into the statute, obligations that cross over to other state agencies and whatever they're doing under their normal statutory provisions, that's the concern. There could be some unintended consequences from that standpoint.
Mm. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Okay. That concludes our sign up in the room, and off net we have nobody in the LIOs, so that will conclude our public hearing portion. Do we have any final questions for the bill sponsor? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and set this bill aside for further review. Next up, House Bill 114 by Representative Ramirez regarding the use of state facilities for disaster aid. This is the first hearing on this bill. The intent today is to hear from the sponsor and have him introduce the bill, take public testimony, and set the bill aside for further review. With us today is Representative Ramirez.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jay Ramirez, District 10, privileged to come before this body. Mr. Chairman, House Bill 114 grew out of events that transpired last year in Western Alaska that people across the state and in the Alaska State Legislature were acutely aware of, which was a food shortage. There were emails that came out of Amonic, and what materialized were 11 Alaskan villages that were in dire straits. I went to see one of the members of your committee very early on, my good friend Senator Olson, and spoke to him about trying to meet that need. And Mr. Chairman, in our effort to try and engage state transportation facilities to assist us in the delivery of that food to Alaskans, we were met with a policy that said the declaration of an economic declaration of disaster was subject to formula 200% of the federal poverty level. And as a result, having raised 40,000 pounds of food and $25,000, we had to spend that money for private transportation of those food resources. So this bill, which we have coined Compassionate Aid, has grown out of that experience. On a trip to Nome with the Energy Committee, Senator Olson and I made a trip independent of the delivery of that food to those 11 villages. We traveled to Kotlik and visited with our fellow citizens there. And I can say, Mr. Chairman, that it is my opinion, and I think one that is widely shared in the Alaska State Legislature, that we should be judged by how we treat the weakest amongst us. And in this case, we did not deliver filet mignon and prawns out to those folks in Western Alaska. We delivered cans of food, flour, sugar, things that we would consider staples here in a more urban area. The Compassionate Aid Bill allows, at the governor's discretion, an extra tool that's in the tool belt to use state transportation facilities if an acute need arises, and nonprofits in the state to choose to respond to that and want to engage the governor or the executive branch in transporting that food, medicine, or that staple need to a distressed community here in Alaska. It's good public policy. There's a zero fiscal note. We addressed some liability issues in in the Senate Transportation Committee with the help of Senator Pascavan, the chair of that committee. We think this is good public policy. And that concludes my testimony, Mr. Chairman.
And do we have any initial questions for the bill sponsor? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a comment. I think that having been involved with the representative on this issue, especially for those villages of mine that are down in the Lower Yukon, it was very frustrating to run up against some of these obstacles that were out there when the need for diapers and baby formula and things like that were so critical at the time because of the extremely low temperatures and the price of the commodities that were out there. And so I speak strongly in favor of this bill.
Okay, we have any other initial questions? Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a comment. I would just like to publicly thank Representative Rammers for all of his efforts on this and the fundraising and the follow-through. And I guess this is one of the things I really admire about him and his efforts is that he does follow through to the extent of anticipating it happening again and how we can be better prepared. So I just say for that, thank you.
Through the Chair. Thank you, Senator Huggins, and thank you, Senator Olson. It was a privilege to work with many of the people in this legislature on resolving this issue and restoring dignity and creating a bridge between urban Alaska and rural Alaska. I think that was the most important thing that came out of this, and to create a lighted pathway, as Senator Huggins said, Mr. Chairman, to address this in the future, because it's inevitable that there will be a need that arises, and there simply isn't a safety net in rural Alaska the way that there is in urban Alaska with food banks. When a community in rural Alaska crashes through their safety net, they often take all of the community or most of the community with them. In urban Alaska, we just have a stronger safety net, and I will ask the committee to look favorably upon this bill, and at the appropriate time, I hope the committee will consider moving it from this committee to the Senate floor. I appreciate you taking time to hear from me, Mr. Chairman.
I suppose as we move forward in time and become a more developed state, we put in a position where we have to put in statute, which we should automatically do when our citizens are in need, and that's respond as the state of Alaska with all means necessary in our transportation corridors that we control or manage to help our communities. So I would imagine this is not going to be the only issue that we have to put in statute where a couple of decades ago we'd just do it.
Mr. Chairman, to be blunt, and I'm trying to be tactful with my language, in a year ago, 14, 16 months ago, was a long time ago in the way we measure time here in this building, I was told in a House caucus by a deputy chief of staff in the administration that it was against the law. They held out a blue statute book, said it was against the law to use state assets to move food from one place where there was an abundance of food and diapers and formula to another place in the state of Alaska for citizens who needed that food. And so House Bill 114 is a response to that Orwellian proposition that we heard. And frankly, Mr. Chairman, that's why there's more than half of the House co-sponsored this bill. It was an emotional response to an incompatible reaction. And I'm glad that the legislature is contemplating a remedy, offering a remedy to that. And I thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And we have 4-0 fiscal notes from the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, and the Department of Fish and Game, and the Department of Veterans Affairs. We've got nobody signed up online or offline, and just a final comment, you know, when the citizens of the state, regardless if it's through severe weather or extremely poor fish runs or we have another earthquake, I don't really care what's in that blue book. The state of Alaska needs to respond to its citizens. That's what we're here to do. Do we have any other final comments? Senator Olson.
With that eloquent argument, Mr. Chairman, we ought to pass this bill out today.
Right. due to the conservative nature of the Senate Finance Committee, we're going to set this bill aside for further review and go on to the next item.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Representative.
House Bill 186 by Representative Kelly regarding the exemption of firearms from federal regulation. This is the first hearing on this bill. The intent today is to hear from this, or have the sponsor introduce the bill, take public testimony, and set the bill aside for further review. With us today is Rep. Kelly.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the Finance Committee. Thank you for hearing HB 186. And since I came from the House Finance Committee where we were hearing Senate bills, I'm sure you'll want to get rid of me as quickly as possible. So my able assistant, Derek Miller, will walk you through the bill, but it is a bill that would say that firearms built in the state of Alaska for use in the state of Alaska would not be subject to the regulation of the federal government, and it would permit the Attorney General, permit, not require, but permit the Attorney General to protect anyone who engages in that production activity from federal interference. So, Mr. Chairman, it's a bill that could cause some challenges at the federal level, but it's our opinion that it should not, because the production of these weapons would not be for entry into interstate commerce. They would be clearly marked made in Alaska. And with that, Mr. Chairman, if I might, I will turn it over to Derek Miller, and I appreciate your hearing this, and I hope Senator Olson makes the same statement about this bill as he did the last one.
Thank you for that testimony. Mr. Miller, can you identify yourself for the record and proceed with your presentation?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Derek Miller, staff to represent Kelly, and I'll just run through the sectional analysis. Section 1 of the bill is a findings section declaring the act, the authority of this act, to be the 2nd, 9th, and 10th Amendments to the Constitution of the United States. Section 2 is the Alaska Firearm Freedom Act, as stated in the bill, and declares that a personal firearm, a firearm accessory, or ammunition that is manufactured commercially or privately in this state and that remains in the state is not subject to federal law or federal regulation. Section 2 applies to a firearm accessory, or ammunition that is manufactured in this state from basic materials without the inclusion of significant parts imported from another state. Section 2C declares that a firearm manufactured or sold in this state and not subject to federal regulation must have the words "made in Alaska" clearly stamped on a central metallic part, such as a receiver or frame. Section 2D permits the Attorney General of Alaska to defend a citizen of the state who is prosecuted by the government of the United States under power to regulate interstate commerce by violating federal law concerning the manufacture, sale, transfer, or possession of a firearm, firearm accessory, or ammunition manufactured and retained within this state. And then finally, Section 2E is the definitions section, defining firearm accessory, defining generic and insignificant parts, and defining the term manufactured. And with that, that is the sectional analysis, Mr. Chairman, and I believe we do have a gentleman by the name of Mr. Gary Marbit online who can speak to any questions that the committee may have.
Thank you, Mr. Miller, for that testimony. There is one indeterminate fiscal note from the Department of Law. Does anyone have any questions from the bill sponsor? Seeing none, Gary Marbit, are you online?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Gary Marbit, the spelling of the last name is M-A-R-B-U-T, calling from Montana. I wrote the original Montana Firearms Freedom Act, from which this and many others have been copied. I should say that although I'm from Montana, I did spend all of the 70s living in Fairbanks and worked for the Fairbanks Fire Department as a firefighter and paramedic and was regional coordinator of emergency medical services there, so I do have some roots in Alaska. This idea has been popular in America. There are now 7 states that have enacted this law, 6 states that have enacted clones of the Montana law, and it's been introduced in 20 other states. So it's an idea, it's a states' rights challenge to Federal Commerce Clause authority using firearms as the vehicle for the exercise, and an exercise that is popular in America. I want to speak to two items about the bill and about the concept, and then I'd be glad to answer any questions. Because you are the Senate Finance Committee, of course, you're interested in what kind of economic impact it might have for Alaska and especially any costs. I do note this question has come up in other states, and our comment in response to that is no state or the federal government has never sued any state over medical marijuana or rejection of real ID. So it's unlikely that there will be any litigation from the federal government pointed towards Alaska over this. We are involved in litigation in Montana, private litigation, where the Montana Shooting Sports Association, of which I am president, and the Second Amendment Foundation have joined to litigate the principles of the Firearms Freedom Act here and to clear those legal hurdles, but that is a private effort. Also, a question that's commonly come up in other states is, what about the success of a challenge? And it's been said that precedent is against what we are attempting to accomplish here, and that we may have slim chances of winning this legal contest. Well, we understand that precedent is against us, but that's exactly the reason for the bill and for the effort. We want to challenge the status quo, and we hope to overturn or reverse a half century of Commerce Clause precedent, whereby the federal government has become entirely too intrusive into the affairs of the states. And as my mother told me, nothing ventured, nothing gained. So we understand precedent is against us, but we do want to forge ahead with the effort, and we recommend this to you, the Senate Finance Committee, and the people of Alaska. So I would be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you for that testimony. There are questions. Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Marbit, Charlie Huggins here from Wasilla. I'm just trying to figure out what categories of firearms in this case would qualify under this bill. I mean, I know in the state we have a few mom-and-pop outfits that do bullets, but we have one bullet company, Kodiak, which is actually here in Juneau, that markets nationally. Would Kodiak bullets, would it fall under this because they're already marketing nationally, or how would that work?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, the answer is probably not. Existing manufacturers must have federal firearms licenses, and for the reasons that you point out, that is, they have a national market and they are shipping in interstate commerce. So this will they would probably not avail themselves of the opportunities under the Firearms Freedom Act. However, manufacture of ammunition and firearms is not rocket science. And a mom-and-pop machine shop could spool up to manufacture Alaska-made items without a lot of difficulty. So those are the kind of people I see potentially becoming players in the state-made guns game.
Senator Huggins? Then, if I could, Mr. Chairman, going into firearms, if I took a Remington 700 action out and myself rolled a shill and barrel into it and, I don't know, a Pacific Research stock and put it all together and zeroed it, and stamped Alaska on the outside of it, would it qualify, or would it have to be if I had Huggins Magnum Actions, which I were casting actions and it did all the things that I described, both of those fit or not?
Mr. Marbit?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Huggins, your first example would not fit. Your second example would fit. The Remington 700 action would be made out of state, has traveled interstate commerce, has been manufactured by somebody who has a federal license to do that, and so that firearm would not be truly an Alaska-made arm under the bill. But the second one, where you're forging, casting, developing your own actions, certainly would be.
Okay, thank you, and thank you very much for all your hard work on this, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Huggins. Further questions from the committee? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Marbit, thanks for coming out this morning or afternoon, whatever it is in there in Montana. But as we look at this legislation, I can understand the application toward manufacturing rifles and things like that. But as we look at some of the crimes that are committed, they're mainly done with handguns and things like the Saturday Night Special types. Would this, in Montana, does your bill include handguns in this legislation?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, yes, it does. And there has been some complaint on the national level that would leave these kind of items unregulated, and our position is that if there's going to be any regulation of them, it ought to be at the state level, and this does not preclude any Alaska regulation of any kind of firearms that you might care to regulate, but we think it's not the business of the federal government to be regulating things that are made and retained in the state.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify on this legislation? Seeing none, we'll set this bill aside for further deliberation. That brings us to House Bill 319. And we have Representative Foster. 319 is a bill regarding firearms. Representative Foster, Representative Hawker, identify yourself for the record and please present the legislation. Sorry about that.
Senator Stedman, Senator Hoffman, and members of the Senate Finance Committee. I frankly take great honor at having been confused with the late Representative Foster, so thank you very kindly. Very much appreciate the opportunity to present today, sirs. House Bill 319 is a bit of a housekeeping bill in some respects, and then it does add one new duty upon, in the interests of protecting Alaska's citizens' rights to own and possess firearms. Our office had worked with a gentleman who is now a senator, but the former Representative Coghill over the summer, and putting this together, so I'd also like to acknowledge his active participation in the development of this bill. Alaskans still, well, even though the state of Alaska has allowed what we call the open carry, we do not require a concealed carry permit to be issued in order to for an individual to carry concealed firearms, we still allow citizens to acquire a concealed handgun carry permit. Primarily, folks would be interested in that because those permits are often recognized by other states for the purposes of reciprocity. So there's a couple of just cleanup elements that exist in our concealed handgun carry laws. One of the so as we go through the bill, the first item in the bill is that it clarifies, and it's frankly a clarification of existing statute that says a permit does not have to be surrendered when it expires, and when a permit holder moves out of state. Purpose of this was that the existing statute that said your permit has to be surrendered when it expires is largely overlooked by folks. And you think about a person who may choose to move out of state, may leave the state. It's cleaning up something that actually is putting an individual into a violation status completely unnecessarily. There's a second point, and it's clarifying language in the existing, the existing statutes say that an expired permit simply cannot be displayed, period. And where that causes problems for some folks in the state of Alaska is there's a couple of gentlemen up in Fairbanks particularly who have some of the one or two of the first concealed handgun permits ever offered in the state of Alaska, lo those many years ago. They have them framed on the wall in their offices, and technically they are in violation of state law because they cannot display their permit. Well, this has been dealt with by regulations within the Department of Public Safety. The individuals involved are still rather concerned that they are, in fact, in de facto violation of statute, and have asked that we make this amendment, which would say that you cannot display an expired permit, or you may display an expired permit, but as long as you're not claiming it to be a valid permit, and basically, you know, allowing it to be hung on the wall as a souvenir. Third element of cleaning up our existing concealed carry statutes, not unlike driver's licenses, these things expire every 5 years, and the current practice of the Department of Public Safety is to not send someone a notice that says, hey, your permit's expiring, if you wish to renew it, please pursue that. This bill does require the Department of Public Safety to mail a notice to the permit holder at least 90 days prior to the expiration of their permit. Would note that there is an extended implementation date of that provision. The reason is that currently the Department of Public Safety and its development of an improved data processing system will be able to offer this service without any additional costs if we wait a year to implement. I think we've got an effective date on that of 2012. However, if we forced that upon them this year immediately, they would have to go through a a separate process that would cost some state funds. So in the interest of cost efficiency and effectiveness there, we've given that an extended date clause. Next, fourth item, clarifying concealed handgun carry permits, is in this bill at the request of the Department of Public Safety, and it's allowing them to, your existing statute talks about only paper documents. This second, or this fourth clause will allow them to use electronic media to post applications and post regulations and statutes to, again, lower costs, improve cost effectiveness now that the internet has become such a ubiquitous part of our data exchanges in the state. Now, the last section of House Bill 319 is the section that actually does have, it would be a new duty that we would be asking local law enforcement officers to pursue. This is an issue related to the process by which an Alaskan, which is a process that is completely sanctioned by current law but not specifically addressed, is how one acquires or goes through the process to obtain and possess a firearm regulated under the National Firearms Act of 1934. This is a very specific class of firearms that require in order to possess one of these, you have to go through a very complete personal federal examination by the FBI, and you have to receive specific federal permission to acquire these firearms as an individual. Specifically, these would be short-barreled rifles, short-barreled shotguns, fully automatic firearms, and a rather esoteric category called an any other weapon. The process of acquiring one of these firearms entails an individual, first off, identifying a firearm they wish to acquire, but then filing with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms a request to take possession of that permit. It's actually a tax form. You have to pay a $200 tax to receive the firearm. So when that request, along with the tax payment, goes to the feds, that requires you to send copies of your fingerprints, copies of, you know, photographs, and they then send it off through a full and complete FBI background examination before they, at the end of the day, sign off on the thing and send it back to you and allow you to take possession of a restricted, or firearm restricted under the National Firearms Act of 1934. The issue that has arisen in several jurisdictions in the state of Alaska, and it's an issue that kind of comes and goes, is that as a prerequisite to filing that application for transfer with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, the individual who makes that application has to approach their own, what is the term of art, is their own chief law enforcement officer, the CLEO. The CLEO is effectively the head of that, or basically the chief law enforcement officer, the chief of police, whatever, in the individual's residential jurisdiction. So in a municipality, it would be the chief of police, and actually the federal regulations allow such things as judges. They've got some latitude in that, but a high-level law enforcement officer. At the state of Alaska, these transfer applications are processed by the Department of Public Safety. As part of the application to the feds, and this, I mean, that's the one that triggers the whole FBI background examination, the application has a courtesy notification provision, and that is you go to that CLEO, and the CLEO is asked to sign in as part of the application and it's a statement of negative assurance. And a key point is negative assurance. That means they don't have to say something positive. This person is. They say, I have no information that would lead me to believe this person might be. And, Mr. Chairman, if it's all right to read the certification that the CLEO must sign, the CLEO's sixth statement of negative assurance is that I have no information indicating that the transferee, in this case the person making the application, the Alaska citizen, I have no information indicating the transferee will use the firearm or device described in this application for other than lawful purposes. And I have no information that the receipt or possession of the firearm or device described in this document would place the transferee in violation of a state or local law. Again, it's a fairly innocuous sign-off, simply saying, we don't have a local law against this, and I don't know anything about this guy that would indicate that he is going to use it illegally. Now, unfortunately, in many places across the United States, as well as it's occurred in Alaska, The chief law enforcement officer has imposed their own will, saying, I simply just don't want someone to have one of these things, where the state of Alaska's state statute specifically authorizes the possession of these firearms as long as one complies with the federal transfer process. Individual law enforcement officers in several cases have usurped that right of Alaska citizens and simply refused to sign this. And when without that signature, the transfer process is stopped dead in its tracks. The bill before us would place a duty upon chief law enforcement officers to provide, or to, and the key word, the word in the bill is execute these forms. And I would make it very clear, as we've talked with the legal counsel on this, in this sense, the word execute, we say that law enforcement officer must execute the form. That means exercise their judgment in signing this. It does not say they shall sign the form. They must sign it regardless of their judgment. But it says that the law enforcement officer has the 30 days to evaluate this, process the form, and the implicit statement is either to sign off or not to sign off on it based on their judgment. I think this is a very important clarification of the legislature's intent that Alaska citizens shall have the freedoms, the Second Amendment rights that we have granted them in our larger body of statute, and that it's just not appropriate for a politically motivated chief law enforcement officer to usurp that right. So again, I think it's a very important improvement in the state's our commitment to supporting and upholding the individual rights of our citizens. Mr. Chairman, that is the presentation of the bill, sir.
Hey, do we have any initial questions for the bill sponsor? We have, seeing none, we have 2-0 fiscal notes from the Department of Public Safety and the Department of Law. We have one person signed up in the room to testify. If he can come forward, please. The bill sponsor maybe retreat. And we'll bring him back in the end, Mr. Dan Boone. You can introduce yourself for the record and who you represent and speak to the bill, please.
For the record, my name is Dan Boone. I represent myself. And as the sponsor so eloquently stated, that I think it's time that I own myself NFA firearms, and the background that you go through ATF and FBI is very extensive, even to possess one of these firearms. And then to move them out of state, again, they're regulated. You need permission from ATF to even move those weapons out of state as well. There's a couple other issues that what I've experienced in Alaska is that if a chief law enforcement officer determines that he or she is not going to exercise their discretion and sign or look at the application, what we have are estates, and what happens is that if I passed away today, and those firearms, those NFA firearms, go into my estate, it puts a heavy burden on the beneficiaries of my estate without the cooperation of the chief law enforcement officer to transfer those weapons into the names of the beneficiaries, as well as to properly dispose of those firearms, and that you're having to solicit, in some instances, individuals from out of state trying to take possession of those firearms. And I do believe that, and then at the same time too, speaking from a small business perspective, that if an individual has a firearms business and they do stock certain type of NFA firearms, the chief law enforcement officer could, at their discretion, literally hamper or hinder that business. They could just shut down that portion of sales by refusing to sign the Form 4s for NFA firearms. So I believe that it's a really good thing for Alaska, considering the fact that the chief law enforcement officer, they're looking at the individual, basically in essence they're saying that there's nothing that I can see of this individual in this community that has demonstrated any kind of unethical behavior, or he has no criminal history that I can tell, and moves it forward. And then when the FBI and ATF Again, it's about a four-month process, so by the time they get it done and by the time the individual actually takes possession of that firearm, it's usually about a five-month process. So that's my testimony, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much.
And where do you reside, Mr. Boone?
I reside in Juneau.
Okay, thank you. Okay, seeing no other questions, we have nobody else signed up. We got a couple people from the department. Kathy Manfreda, if you can introduce yourself for the record and who you represent, and let us know if the department supports this bill.
For the record, my name is Kathy Manfreda. I am the Chief of the Criminal Records and Identification Bureau for the Department of Public Safety and the Permits and Licensing Section, which includes the Concealed Handgun Permit Program, falls under my management. We are supportive of this with one little caveat. We just wanted to make it known for the record that we do believe that passage of this bill may jeopardize reciprocity with some of the states that we currently have reciprocity with.
Okay. Do you have any questions for the department? Seeing none, may we have Rip Hawker back, please? Do we have any closing questions, final questions for Rep. Hawker on his bill?
Yeah,
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a comment. Number one, thanks for bringing the bill forward. I hear a lot of these concerns from people. I go to gun shows every time I hear about them, and some I've asked to be told about so that I don't miss any. And that's one of my problems of being in Juneau is I miss some gun shows. But my comment is very simple. My good friend, the late Richard Foster, is now smiling today, and thank you for making him smile.
Thank you, sir. And if I might, Mr. Chairman, I would like to a quick response clarifying the issue raised by the Department of Public Safety on reciprocity. This is an issue they brought up. You heard it was very cautious concern, saying it may, it might, there, you know, some degree element of concern. I've raised this issue with the Western Region National Rifle Association. In those conversations, they have seen no problems and with this issue, and it, the core of the issue gets to being a state resident, where someone might be able to, you know, you have a concealed carry permit, you are not required, not mandated in this case, to be an Alaska state resident. You have to be a state resident to acquire your license, but if you start to move around the country, you can maintain your concealed carry permit for those privileges in Alaska. As they raise that question, and what I would offer as the point of the most immediate rebuttal is we just pulled up the Colorado states, and in fact that was one of the states that was cited as a concern of the Department of Public Safety in previous testimony, and they're concerned that, well, if an Alaskan does not have to remain a resident to keep their concealed carry permit, will it be invalid in the state of Colorado? Well, we have several states already existing that do not even require residency in which to apply for a concealed carry permit. An Alaska citizen can go to both Florida and Utah and apply for a concealed carry permit in those states without ever having been a resident. And in the documentation we have, those states are both recognized for residency in Colorado. So again, we've got both the NRA's testimony and the I think this factual information here that indicates that that's why I have no anxiety over this issue if we're to pass this legislation, sir.
Okay, that concludes the initial hearing on this bill. We'll set this bill aside for further review. We are going to move House Bill 315 to this afternoon's meeting at 1:30, as we've been called to the floor. Again, House Bill 315, 1:30, Senate Finance, meeting adjourned.